they were literally building these pyramids. And on top of the pyramid, they were building crystal lingams. They were putting giant crystal blocks as though they were literally making an actual communication with the gods.
Do you think this is because there was a cultural notion that the gods were beings in the sky or beings from space?
If you come to India or if you come to Southeast Asia, our stories, all our ancient texts are very crystal clear about this, that our gods came from the sky. That's literally what the ancient texts are telling us. Shiva is coming from another planet. And all these interstellar travel, interplanetary travel is mentioned again and again in ancient texts. Before, 1945, when Ramayana and Mahabharata talk about, you can just drop a weapon and the entire city can be demolished and all the trees can be burning and all the generations of people will get diseases. People thought that, this is just pure nonsense. I mean, there's no weapon that can destroy an entire city, until the atomic bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The reptile-like beings are very, very common in ancient temples.
How do you interpret that? Is this a metaphor? Is it an archetype? Or is it a memory of contact with beings who actually looked like that?
Ancient Indian texts clearly say that these are not symbols. These are reptile-like beings that coexisted with humans and with gods. Sarpa or Naga, sometimes it's called, very commonly known as Naga as well. The Sarpas are capable of shape-shifting.
Were they able to date the paintings that look like UFOs? And when you say they look like UFOs, are we talking flying saucers or some other kind of shape?
This episode of The Fifth Kind is brought to you by Ancient Knowledge Academy, a learning community for anyone interested in human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.
Today's guest is known worldwide for his research into the symbology found in ancient temples around the world. His quest has taken him to Peru, Indonesia, and Cambodia, but focuses chiefly on the ancient treasures found in India. He's guested on History Channel's Ancient Aliens, and across four languages has built his own platform to more than 4 million subscribers. Praveen Mohan, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Paul. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you once again here on The Fifth Kind. Our viewers will know you from your own channel and from our previous conversations. My readers will have spotted you in my most recent book, The Eden Enigma, where you and I are talking about the handbag of the gods at the Avodaya Temple in Tamil Nadu, if you remember that conversation.
Yes.
But today we're going somewhere we've not gone before. You're going to be talking to us about the pyramids and temples of Thailand, which is something new to me. So are there pyramids in Thailand?
Yes. Yes, there are pyramids in Thailand. There's one particular pyramid that has caught my attention. It has remained a secret for a long time. And the name of this pyramid is Setep Pyramid. Okay. So there are two pyramids in the Setep Historical Park. This is in Thailand, and there's one particular pyramid that's really looks very much like the Egyptian or Mesoamerican pyramids, okay? And it's very large. Each side is about 210 feet long. And, of course, it's been destroyed a little bit, but you can see that this is a huge pyramid, and it has remained a secret for probably thousands of years, okay? And it was discovered only in this century. And, of course, archaeologists or giving it a conservative estimate of 1,300 years. But in reality, it could be much, much older than this. Now, this pyramid is actually very mysterious because nobody knows even the original name of this pyramid. Okay, people just call it Khao Klang Nok in Thailand. That means the mountain on the outside. There's another pyramid inside as well. And so what we do is we're going to Thailand in about 20 days. And we actually go and climb this pyramid. And you can feel the energy as you climb up. And at the top of it, you can see a giant structure. It's been destroyed now. The standard theory, there used to be a stupa on top of this or a temple on top of this. But some say there was a giant crystal cylinder, like a giant crystal lingam or like a crystal egg on top. Very much, for example, that transmits energy.
So how is there so much uncertainty about the age of this structure? Are there no references to it through written history to give us a clue?
No, they don't, right? Because, dating a structure like this is very complicated. It could be simpler, but people make it very complicated, right? For example, there are no accurate scientific ways of determining the age of stone. Even though this is made of bricks, what people do is all the structures made of stone, they're inorganic, right? They're not organic material. So there's no accurate way of radiocarbon dating them. So what do archaeologists do? Archaeologists would probably find a piece of charcoal or some skeleton bones and then date that and then claim that that's the date of a temple or, for example, in this pyramid. Now, but for example, right? So let's say my grandfather builds a house that's like, you know, maybe 200 years old. And then my grandchild buries a piece of charcoal. When archaeologists find that charcoal, they're about 200 years off because they're only dating the charcoal and they cannot really accurately date, you know, the stones in the house. And this presents a lot of problems, actually. This is one of the key issues with archaeology, is the dating of the structures. All the structures, not only in Thailand, in India, in Cambodia, the famous Angkor Wat Temple, the famous Phimai Temple in Thailand, archaeologists somewhat sheepishly accept that there is no accurate way of telling the age of a temple, right? So if you take, for example, a piece of stone, right? So I give you a stone statue and you have to tell me when it was created. How would you date the stone, right? The stone itself, right? That piece of granite itself has been there for millions of years, you see, right? So even if you have a way to find out, you know, how old that granite piece is, it's just the age of the granite block.
Yes.
Right. So how do you determine when it was chiseled?
Yes. Right?
Yeah. So this is a big problem in archaeology.
And the pyramid you're describing, to what extent is it a stepped pyramid? To what extent is it a smooth-sided pyramid? What kind of structure are we looking at?
So right now it is very much similar to a Mesoamerican pyramid. Each side is about 210 feet wide. Now it's only about 65 or maybe 80 feet tall. Once upon a time, it was much, much larger because people have tried to destroy what's on top. But right now, you only have two large steps. Okay. There is a staircase in the middle and you can walk up easily, but there are two large steps, but it probably had two or three more levels about once upon a time.
And is there any local sort of folklore around what the purpose of this pyramid was?
You know, the standard stories, right? So when you talk to the locals, it gets very, very interesting. There are many pyramids. When we talk about pyramids, we only think of Egyptian pyramids or Mayan pyramids, right? Because those are the most popular ones. But there are a lot of Hindu pyramids and Buddhist pyramids. The classic examples of Hindu pyramids are Ahikshetra in Bareilly in India, and then Kokar pyramid in Cambodia. And if you want to talk about the Buddhist pyramids, the Borobudur temple in Indonesia would be an example of a Buddhist pyramid. So the Hindus and Buddhists also built pyramids in India and Southeast Asia. Now, but what is the story? If you go and talk to the locals anywhere where you find a Hindu or a Buddhist pyramid, what they say is that it was a way to communicate to the gods. The higher the structure, they were able to communicate to the gods better. And this is a very interesting point, right? Because we all know the Indian temples. But if you start thinking about the Indian temples and the Vimanas, they're also kind of pyramids, right? So when you hear the story, you know, they were building these pyramids to communicate with the gods. You can take it in a spiritual way. You know, they were building these pyramids to communicate to the gods. They were doing rituals and so on and so forth. But it's also like, let's say Paul is calling me over the cell phone, right? And I'm at the ground level, and you're calling me over the cell phone, and I'm not getting a signal. Now, my natural instinct is to raise my arm and try to find a signal, right? And if I'm really in the middle of a jungle, what I'm going to do is I'm going to climb a tree and then try to find a signal, right? Because I'm trying to communicate with you, right? So we see this like kind of a parallel analogy that they were literally building these pyramids. And on top of the pyramid, they were building crystal lingams. They were putting giant crystal blocks as though they were literally making an actual communication with the gods, you know, just like radio wave communications, you know.
Now, do you think this is because there was a cultural notion that the gods were beings in the sky or beings from space? Or do you really think that there may have been an attempt to create some kind of technology that would facilitate remote communication? Which do you think it is?
Yes, I mean, if you come to India or if you come to Southeast Asia, our stories, all our ancient texts are very crystal clear about this, that our gods came from the sky. You know, when people talk about, oh, the Hindu gods, you know, is Pravin Mohan saying Hindu gods are aliens? There is no derogatory implication there, because we're not comparing them with the alien grays coming in UFOs like the Hollywood movies, right? But that's literally what the ancient texts are telling us. Shiva is coming from another planet called Shivaloka. Vishnu is coming from another planet called Vishnuloka. And all these interstellar travel, interplanetary travel is mentioned again and again in ancient texts. Ancient texts like Ramayana in India talk about how they were using Vimanas to go from one country to another. For example, in India, it's very common that, you know, I take a plane from Chennai and I go and land in Colombo in Sri Lanka. But this same air travel is actually mentioned in the ancient text of Ramayana, written thousands of years ago. They literally talk about, you know, how Ravana took a plane from India and he flew back to his palace in Sri Lanka, right? And they talk about interplanetary travel. Today, I mean, just think about this, right? 100 years ago, before, you know, the modern planes were invented by Wright brothers, this would have sounded completely absurd, right? This text, ancient text, saying that, oh, how can they fly from India to Sri Lanka? How can a piece of metal just fly in the air? It just sounds like complete nonsense. It did sound like complete nonsense, right? And all the, you know, the mainstream historians and even the scientists at that time, they completely started to fling mud on this theory, saying that, you know, how is this even possible that they were just flying in the air? Until Wright brothers made it possible, right? And then, yes, you know, yeah, so 75, before what, 1945, right? When Ramayana and Mahabharata talk about, oh, you can just drop a weapon and the entire city can be demolished and all the trees can be burning and all the generations of people will get diseases, right? So people thought that, oh, this is just pure nonsense. I mean, there's no weapon that can destroy an entire city, until the atomic bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right?
Right? Exactly, so, exactly. So we now have the frameworks to listen to these ancient stories and understand what we're being told in a way our ancestors of 100, 200 years ago did not. And so it sharpens up the question for us of what do we do with those stories? How do we regard them? And I'm interested to know how people living in a world where the worldview is dominated by Hinduism or Buddhism, how do they read these ancient texts? Do they think they're talking about something real that happened, or do they regard it as fable?
Well, of course, you know, the dynamics are changing because of all the Western influence and globalization. You know, it's obviously changing. But there's still, I mean, we still have 1 billion people in India who worship a variety of Hindu gods. And that's why I call India, you know, the last bastion of a pagan civilization, right? Because in Egypt, people no longer worship the Ra or Thoth, right? In Greece, people no longer worship Hercules or, you know, all these, Thor, for example, right? All these gods have become kind of superheroes in Hollywood movies, right? But in India, we still have this unbroken chain. We still have 1 billion people who are worshiping a variety of Hindu gods. You know, we have not given up our rituals and beliefs, and we're still reading all the ancient texts. Now, today, a lot of people who believe in scientism and they think it's science, they come out and say, oh, but this is completely irrelevant in this ancient Indian text. And we can just say, just wait, you know, just wait for 10 or 20 years. You know, the people used to laugh at flying machines to other countries. All they had to do was just wait. People used to laugh at Brahmastra, which is basically the atom bomb. And it became true, you know, less than a century ago. So if you find something that's unbelievable in ancient texts, or if that something is really like absurd, just wait for a few decades, because we may be behind on our science, right? Because ancient texts repeatedly show, right? And they're much more advanced than us. They're talking about time travel. Okay, they're talking about terraforming. Like in one of the stories I was recently reading this, and it blew my mind, because it's very similar to what Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are talking about, which is going to a planet like Mars and make it inhabitable to human beings. Mm. Okay, and this is mentioned in ancient texts. This is mentioned that, you know, they tried to put a man in another planet, and that planet was not inhabitable, you know, was not, you know, very compatible with humans. So they literally terraformed that planet, right, to make it inhabitable to humans. They're talking about time dilation in ancient texts. There's one god who actually flies, he does interstellar travel, right? It's for a short time, but when he comes back, he realizes that all his generation has passed away, right? And we hundreds, centuries and centuries have gone on Earth, while he has only traveled for a short period of time. And this is called time dilation. And this is mentioned in ancient Indian texts.
What you say, ancient Indian texts, what is the age of the texts that have these incredible concepts in them that are new to us in the 20th and 21st century, but are clearly ancient in other parts of the world? Just how ancient are those texts?
Well, I mean, even officially we say that the oldest Hindu text that we know of is known as the Rig Veda. Okay, it's commonly believed that this is about 5,000 years old. And this is a very conservative estimate that it's about 5,000 years old. Okay, but according to Hindus, it's much, much older in time. We're talking about like 10,000, 15,000, 100,000 years old. So this is the timeline that we talk about. It's very common that if you go to Wikipedia today, if you go to the history page of any Wikipedia page, you can see people arguing about the timeline of these ancient texts. Now, we know that we could probably radiocarbon date the palm leaf of, for example, a copy of the Rig Veda, but it's also commonly understood that originally the Rig Veda was just transmitted through reciting it to future generations. They did not even start to write it down for a very, very long time. It was in some places, they even say it's forbidden to write down the Vedas. It was originally just transferred orally to people. So you can imagine, how old this must have been. If you go to an ancient... if you go to an ancient temple in India, we see you will hear two types of histories, okay? So one is a plaque put by the archaeology department. That plaque will say, okay, so this temple was built by an ancient king maybe 700, 800 years ago. But if you go and talk to the priest who is performing the rituals in the temple, he will tell you a completely different history. He's going to tell you how a particular god built it thousands of years ago, okay? Or how people built it in memory of this god, again, going back thousands of years ago. So a lot of times, these temples were built during the time of Rama or Krishna. For example, Lord Krishna is supposed to have walked the earth 5,000 years ago. And a lot of temples were dedicated to Krishna or said to be built around that time.
Is there anything in these ancient texts that hints at the existence of pyramids or the purpose of pyramids?
No, they are obviously, we coined the name pyramids fairly recently, I would assume, but they only talk about the Vimanas. Okay, yes. So they talk about the Vimanas, which is like an aerodynamic, like a flying machine. And the term Vimana means a flying machine as well as a temple tower. When we say pyramids today, you're probably thinking about the Great Pyramid of Giza that looks very much like a triangle, right? Or you're looking at maybe Chichen Itza, again, looking at a triangle. But if you just use your imagination a little bit, you will realize that all Hindu temples also have a pyramidal shape. They usually have a pyramidal shape. Maybe the top portion has a little bit of dome or some variation, but it usually have the same pyramidal shape. And it has multiple levels too. You can climb them very much like the Mesoamerican pyramids.
Yes. When I went to India for the first time when I was 11 years old, I remember driving around the cities and looking at the buildings and the temples created. And to my 11-year-old mind, I was seeing technology everywhere. So I was seeing Vimanas, and to me, they looked like flying craft. They didn't just look like architectural conventions. And I'm just fascinated. It's something I'd love to study more, but there seems to be much more of an embracing of the idea of technology both in those built forms, but also in the texts themselves that speak very openly about things we would call aircraft or spacecraft or armaments or bombs. It is quite a different world. So I just find that really intriguing. I just wondered if there's anything that you had read and you thought, yes, this is talking about this kind of structure. But I want to go to the other end of the pyramid. We talked about getting to the top of the pyramid for communication, which makes a lot of sense to me. What about underneath? Because there's been a lot of excitement in recent months about what is or may be underneath the pyramids of Giza. In your research, have you found interesting structures underneath the pyramids of Thailand?
Yes, we do have a lot of underground chambers found underneath the temples of Thailand. In this particular Sitep pyramid, we don't know what's underneath. There should be something definitely underneath, because I literally am starting to think that we are having a completely wrong idea about these pyramids, right? After the LIDAR scans came out, I think literally we're just looking at the tip of the iceberg. I think that's the pyramid. We're just awestruck by this magnificent pyramid, right? And how did they create this giant pyramid and all that stuff? But in reality, I think the 80, 90% of the structure is actually underground. And I think this is what we're starting to see now with the Giza pyramid. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of more scans are going to come out, which are going to show us that the real mystery, that the real structure is not what we see on top of the ground level, it's at the bottom. Now, in Thailand, there's one particular temple called Wat Ratchaburana, and in this structure, and of course, I'm going to go in about 20 days to this temple. We will be climbing this temple, and there's a particular altar. There's a main chamber where we go and we pray to the Lord Buddha that once existed, but just under, you know, our feet, it goes 100 feet down. There's like three different underground chambers just below the main chamber, okay? And it was discovered a few decades ago. And what happened was they found about 100 kilograms of gold in these underground chambers. So, and they not only found gold, they also found strange paintings that looked like UFOs. They found a golden stupa, which has like an antenna-like device on that stupa. And at the very bottom level, they found a lot of like seven layers of lingam-like coverings. And there is like a golden Buddha at the very center, looking at a crystal. And we can see all this today in the Bangkok Museum. It's still housed there.
Wow. Were they able to date the paintings that look like UFOs? And when you say they look like UFOs, are we talking flying saucers or some other kind of shape?
So there is a particular shape that looks like this. There's like a big circle, and there's a smaller circle, like a donut. And you can see a lot of small circles carved on the donut, okay? So this is typically a UFO would appear when you look at it from the ground level. So it looks like a ring, and in the ring, you'll see smaller circles. And this pattern appears again and again. I saw this in Thailand. But this pattern also appears again and again in carvings of Indian temples and also in prehistoric rock art. This pattern appears even in Indian rock art, which is dated very, very like ancient times.
I'm very interested in symbology that recurs around the world. And we certainly do have images that look like flying discs in the carvings of cultures around the planet. Another motif that keeps recurring that I want to ask you about is reptilian entities. So all these diverse cultures will have, and very often it'll be represented linguistically as well, there'll be a word that is a crossover between a snake and a dragon. And in English, that word is serpent. And many cultures talk about serpents, feathered serpents, draconic entities, reptilian beings. Have you found anything along those lines in your research in Thailand?
Yes, absolutely. So a lot of temples in Thailand, for example, the Phimai Temple in Thailand, the Phanamrang Temple in Thailand, all have giant serpents all around these temples. Okay, we call them sarpa. Again, you can see the linguistic connection between serpent, also known as seraph, also yes, known as sarpa. So it's the same thing. It's the same word that appears all over the world. As yes, people call it, yeah, serpent, seraph, sarpa. It's the same thing. And the reptile-like beings are very, very common in ancient temples. It's absolutely, you won't find a Hindu temple without this sarpa motif. Like it's that common. So go ahead.
How do you interpret that? Is this a metaphor? Is it an archetype, or is it a memory of contact with beings who actually looked like that?
Ancient Indian texts clearly say that these are not symbols. These are reptile-like beings that coexisted with humans and with gods. They're very similar to fallen angels. They, for example, the gods always lived in the heavens, and sometimes they came from the sky to the earth. But the serpents or the sarpa always lived underground. They guarded the underworld. They preferred to live underground. And sometimes they would come and make contacts with the humans. Now, the sarpa or naga, sometimes it's called, very commonly known as naga as well, the sarpas are capable of shape-shifting. They could, if they wanted to, they would just come, and we have beautiful carvings of the sarpa coming from the underground, literally shape-shifting. They look like a snake at the very bottom, and they're slowly changing shape. They're slowly starting to look like human beings as they approach the ground level. We have 1,300-year-old carvings of this at Mahabalipuram. So you can see how the serpents were capable of shape-shifting, and they were coexisting with human beings at one point of time. And, you know, the sarpas are known for the shape-shifting. They're known for blending into the environment. They were known sometimes to make offsprings with human beings. So all this is clearly mentioned in ancient Indian texts. And believe it or not, when I was exploring in Cambodia, I talked to some of the students, you know, who were history students of Cambodia, you know, the local Cambodians. And I was floored because they read in their history books that their very first queen is actually a sarpa or naga. The very yes, first, it's amazing that they actually, I mean, we're not talking about their mythology. It's actually found in their mainstream history books that their origin starts with the Nagas kind of communicating with the humans and creating this entire empire.
I find it astonishing how prevalent this story is, that there was a time when our ancestors were governed by non-human entities, reptilian entities, and then the reptilians were succeeded by human kings and queens and leaders. And in my books, I've given examples of this from Southern Africa. It's there in the biblical narratives as well. You can find it in Chinese narratives, Central American. I mean, you can't get more diverse than that. It is such a widespread story. And yet very often around the world, these traditional stories have been sort of deleted and replaced when empires turn up and take over. And so, you know, the British have gone into other people's countries and replaced all that with British Christianity. And Islam has done the same in other parts of the world. But this folklore never gets extinguished. It still survives around the world. And it's the agreement of these narratives that really catches my attention. I find it extraordinary that there are parts of the world where this is still presented as, well, this is our deep history. Yes. And I think living in the West, living in Australia or America or Britain, we always hear these stories as mythology. And we need to know there are other parts of the world we can go to where we will be told this is our deep history. And it's a belief I've come to simply through working on the translation of ancient texts. So I'm 100% with you in what you're saying, Praveen. My next question is about our ancestors again and our relationship in our ancestral past with these structures. Because the last time we spoke, you mentioned that people would make pilgrimage to, whether they're going to a pyramid or a ziggurat or to something we would call a temple, people could go for all kinds of reasons. And it might be cultural, it might be around harvest festivals, there might be religious reasons, but there would also be a trickle of people going to these places because they want physical healing. And there's something about different places that it was understood would help people actually get relief from physical problems or emotional problems. Is that part of the pattern of pilgrimage and temple going in Thailand?
Yes, yes. This Thailand tour that we're having is also like a pilgrimage. So what we observed was, of course, I've been researching the Thailand temples for a few years now, but when I took a group of people for the Thailand tour like 2 months ago, I found that about 4 or 5 people who came were depressed, or they were not feeling up to the mark health-wise. And what happened was it had kind of a healing effect on them. And I attribute this to these ancient temples. You know, the ancient temples have a healing quality to them. We find that there is something magical about these temples. They seem to be healing people physically and mentally. People like Hugh Newman, who I work with, he calls it megalithomania, meaning that humans have this natural tendency to like these big blocks of stone. You know, they have this megalithomania. They feel instantly happy to see these giant structures. But I find that the Hindu and Buddhist temples, there's something about the architecture itself that makes you feel very positive about, you know, life itself when you go into these temples. The temples start like at the ground level, and you slowly start to kind of go up the elevation. So there's something there that you're slowly kind of escalating your mood. You feel happier and happier. And as you go towards, you know, the main chamber, you're going to see a variety of carvings. And the carvings are going to show like dancing women. The carvings are going to show animal behavior. The carvings are going to show a lot of things, right? Even people, you know, performing various type of art, juggling and all this fancy stuff, even erotica. And when you enter this main chamber, there's no carving on the walls. There's nothing on the walls. There's usually one giant stone structure, and it just looks like a cylinder. Okay, we call this a lingam. Or if it's a Buddhist temple, you'll see just one statue of Buddha. And your mind kind of acts in a very strange way, because as you're walking, you know, from the outside into the Hindu or Buddhist temple, you're looking at a variety of carvings. You're like a kid in a candy store observing everything, because there's not an inch of wall space that does not have a carving. Everything is completely covered with carvings. But when you go into the main chamber, your attention is completely focused on the main statue, because there are no carvings on the walls at all. And the main statue is usually made of a completely different stone, a shiny black, almost like a metallic stone. And it has a very calming, healing effect on you. And what we do in Thailand, we don't get to do this in India, you know, sadly. In Thailand, we are able to sit in the main chamber around the statue, and we're able to chant mantras. We're able to chant in, you know, synchronize our chanting, which has an amazing effect on people. You know, it's really fascinating that these temples have this healing quality to them. There's one more temple that I'm going to take people to. This is almost on the Cambodian border. And this temple is called the Phnom Rang Temple. And in this temple, once upon a time, there used to be a lingam made of 9 different materials. This is called Navapashana in ancient Sanskrit. It's called Navapashana. And in India, we have one temple. This is called the Palani Temple, right? So far, you can call it speculation, right? We're saying, oh, if we go into this ancient chamber and we sit around and we chant mantras, it can heal us. You know, this is very much like, oh, you know, it could even be placebo effect. But in some temples, ancient siddhas who were saints, they would actually create the main structure not made of stone, but they would take 9 different herbs and make them into a paste, solidify them, and make them into lingams, okay, or statues. And it would become like rock solid. It would look like a stone, but it's actually made of Navapashana or 9 different toxins. So what happens when in Hinduism, we pour water on top of the statue every day? This is a ritual, okay? And what happens to that water, right? People don't know what happens to that water, right? People say, oh, they're just bathing the statues. No, this water is collected, and the devotees drink this water. Sometimes they put it on their head. Sometimes they take it to, and they rub it on their bodies. And sometimes they drink this. So the idea was basically this. They made this big Navapashana lingam made of 9 herbs. And when you pour water on it, there's a very small amount of this healing material that goes into the water, right? And people ingest that water and it heals them. So, and this Navapashana lingam was once found in the Phnom Rang temple. So today, if you go to the main chamber, you can see an entire water filtration system of what happens when the Navapashana lingam is, you know, when they take the water from the Navapashana. You're not supposed to drink it directly. You're supposed to filter it. And all this is found in the Thailand temple of Phnom Rang.
Wow. When you talked about the pouring of the water, I thought you were going to go somewhere else, because when we talked before, we talked about temples where water over dense magnetic rock creates an E-field, and human bodies can sense that. So there's this whole other aspect of the use of water in temples as well. And it's geared towards healing the people who have gone there. I find that really fascinating. How many times have you taken groups to this particular temple now, Praveen?
This would be the third time. The first time was done last year. I took a small group of people as a private tour. This August, we took about 17 people. And we're doing another one in November. It's only 20 days away.
Oh, that's so exciting. What kind of feedback have you had from the people you've taken?
We are only taking a very small group of people, right? So we don't want to take like 100 or 200 people, right? Because I can't answer all their questions personally. But yeah, it was, everybody loved it. The people just absolutely loved it. Like I said, some people did experience, you know, healing. We cover a lot of different aspects. For example, we cover ancient technology, how they created these structures. We focus on spirituality, where people are sitting around in the main chamber chanting mantras. We focus on all like carvings, the stories of Ramayana, the stories of Buddha, the underground structures, you know, what kind of treasures were found, how could they have, you know, created this, what has happened over, you know, the last 1,000 years, how they're changed, how the Nagas are shown, you know, the Nagas are shown with chakras, and, you know, what is the implication of that, the symbolism. We go through all aspects of temples, and people absolutely loved it. You know, I'm sure, I don't know if it was 100% perfect, but I, because it's a small group, right? So I'm able to get their feedback individually. So, but everybody said they absolutely loved it.
I'm very tempted to join you on one of these tours, Praveen. I must say, are you going to write a book about what you're learning in Thailand, or is it all for the channel?
I haven't written a book in 10 years. The only book I wrote was Coral Castle, Everything You Know Is Wrong. It's slowly becoming like a cult classic kind of book. I see every month people buying it and writing me emails that, you know, this book is giving them a lot of ideas and things like that. But I haven't written a book in 10 years because, you know this, you wrote a book. It must have been very
grueling. It's hard work.
Yeah.
It's hard. What's difficult is to write a book and do other things. I think that's the challenge.
Exactly. When I wrote Coral Castle, when I was writing that book, I did not have much things to do. I was a small timer at the time. I only had one channel, and I would post maybe one video every 2 weeks. So you imagine having the free time.
It was easier.
Yes, it was easier. And again, you know, the books, you know this very well, right? So once you put it in print, you know, there's no way of changing that. So you better make it really solid, right?
Well, I find you have to keep writing so that you can correct all your mistakes. So once you're in, you have to keep going.
Yeah.
So tell us what's coming up. Sorry, I interrupted there.
It's okay. Well, there are a lot of we do have a lot of publishers asking me to write a book. But yeah, I noticed that it takes an enormous amount of time to write a book, and I didn't want to do like a shallow, just use ChatGPT or something like that. That I didn't want to take any shortcuts, and this is true of the videos as well.
Definitely.
If you go and see my channel, on almost all the videos, I'm literally there. I'm going there. I'm going through the underground chambers, crawling through the the dark corners. You'll see that, like, I've literally gone there, experienced that. You can see that I've thought about the structures, because, you know, that's really what I would like to do. Because I don't want to make any shallow content. And again, even with the Thailand tour, you know, we don't take more than 20 people.
Yes.
We Yes, because then if it becomes a large group, I may not be able to answer everybody's questions. I may not be able to give them the personal, touch that I can give. So we only take a small group because there is a lot of joy in doing, think small and like having a small group, right?
Definitely, because you can then have the experiences together. Those conversations are so valuable. I just got back from a tour in the Van province. We had 30 people, and we found that was actually a good size. We were able to have conversations. We all got to know each other. We bonded as a group. I think much bigger than that, and it begins to change. So I totally get where you're coming from. So I know you've got your tour coming up in November to Thailand. There may be one or two spaces left available for that. What's next for Praveen? What are your future projects?
I do have a lot of things lined up. I have a lot of conferences now. It seems to be the conference season now. It's like every month we have like two or three conferences. I've signed up for a few. They've invited me to talk. Almost all of them are in the US or in the UK. So the next year is going to be, I would probably spend half my time in the US or maybe in Europe. We're doing an Egypt tour as well. I'm co-hosting an Egypt tour with a lot of big, the Filippo Biondi and Armando May, the guys who discovered the underground structures. So I'm co-hosting a tour with them. I think it's in March. I'm in a lot of these circles and they've added me. But I have to double check the numbers when they're having the tour and so on. So, and again, we spoke, before recording and you said, when are you doing an India tour, right?
Yes, I would come for an India tour with you, definitely.
Yes. We are still working this out. I do try to make, everything perfect. Like, I want to make sure that all the micro details, the last thing I want to have is like an unsatisfied participant, right? You don't want to come to India and then find out, oh, this is not working. The temples were closed, this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yes, no, a lot of moving pieces if you're doing a tour in India, that's for sure. Praveen, it's been a great pleasure catching up with you again. While you're here, let people know how they can keep up with you and keep abreast of the work that you're doing.
Just go to my YouTube page, simply Praveen Mohan, okay? So my YouTube handle is Real Praveen Mohan, but if you just type in Praveen Mohan, my channel is going to come, and I have about 2.3 million followers as of date or something similar to that. But you can go and see all my latest videos there. I would post at least once a week. You can go to my Facebook page. It has about 1.4 million followers, or you can go to my Instagram. So wherever you go, just say or type Praveen Mohan, and you would probably find my page. That's where I post. I don't have like a personal website, or I don't sell a lot of merch or do a lot of commercial activities. So if you do want to join the tour, you can go to PraveenMohanGlobal.com. I'm sure Paul is probably going to post a link. If you don't mind, you can post a link. And then you can just go there and you can sign up for the tour. It's only 20 days away, so so you'd have short notice. But if you're in Australia, Thailand is like easy peasy, right? So it's like a few hours.
Right. Only a few hours. That's right. Exactly. Praveen, thank you.
How many hours is it?
It's further than you might think. I think probably you're going to be looking at something like a 14-hour flight, but it will be worth it.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I think I totally misunderstood that. I thought it was maybe 6 hours or something. No?
And it depends. Well, it depends what part of Australia as well, because we're a big landmass, a long way from anywhere else. But I want to thank you for your time today, Praveen. It's been really fun talking to you once again. I look forward to our next catch up, which will either be here or in Thailand or in India.
Yes, sir. Yes, absolutely. I would love to have you, by the way, or your followers. You know, I noticed that you have an excellent community, Paul. You know, you must be doing something really, like, very good.
We're working hard. We've set up Ancient Knowledge Academy, which is for a more of a community experience, because it's very difficult to build community in YouTube comments where people get all sorts of attack and trolling. But at Ancient Knowledge Academy, it really is just for people who are motivated by these kinds of topics, and where we can learn together. We've created courses that are really designed as pools of community for people to go on learning journeys together. So it's really exciting building that. And we must have you there sometime as well, Praveen, because I know that people will be very interested to keep up with all the things that you are finding on your travels. We'll have to turn that into a course as well.
I would be delighted to work with you. You know, I think you're doing an amazing job, Paul, and I look forward to working with you and your community.
Oh, likewise. Thanks, Praveen. We'll look forward to next time.
Thank you. Bye.
All the best.
Thank you. Bye.
If you enjoy exploring the kind of topics that we explore on The Fifth Kind, on the Paul Wallace Channel, and in my Eden series, then Ancient Knowledge Academy is the learning community for you. A learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. We've been told ancient texts about the gods are just myths. Close encounters and anomalous experiences are just fantasy. And ancient wisdom is just irrelevant. But what if the knowledge of our ancestors is not just a reservoir of information about the past, but a roadmap to a better and bigger human experience? Ancient Knowledge Academy is an opportunity for more intentional community, more immersive learning, and a chance to connect with researchers and truth seekers from all around the world. And I will keep our feet on the ground as we explore these stretching topics. And with every subject that we bring to the courses and modules at the Academy, I will always take us to ancestral wisdom and ancient knowledge, believing that what we have in indigenous story and ancestral narratives are resources not just to understand the past, but to understand ourselves in a truer light and equip ourselves for life in the 21st century. Courses at the Academy will include all new material, audio, video, and written resources, and live face-to-face elements, so that we can make this learning journey together and in real time. And the Academy enables me to connect more closely with more people who are motivated to make a paradigm-shifting journey and transform their lives. Are you ready? Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.